I'm Jewish.
I'm so Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
A lot of people say, I'm Jewish, I'm proud of being Jewish. First thing I ask them is, why?
I'm Jewish. Make something of it.
We start this fourth and final segment with Rabbi Hirscher on the topic of kashrut, which is the Hebrew term for keeping kosher. What is the Reform view?
The question of kashrut in Reform, and those who look at the Reform movement or Reform Jews and notice that most don't observe kashrut. Some will observe it to varying degrees, but most don't observe it in the way that it's traditionally defined. By the way, while I can't speak as a, I'm not a conservative rabbi, I think that certainly in Los Angeles you'll find a lot of members of conservative congregations that have varying degrees of kashrut observance as well. And while it used to be the case that you could differentiate, you'd know whether someone was observing kashrut or not by which synagogue they were members of, not always the case anymore. So that you've got conservative Jews who observe and some who don't. Within the Reform movement, there is no official position. That is, the Reform movement doesn't say to you, you should observe it or you shouldn't observe it. What the Reform movement would say regarding kashrut is, this is how Jews have eaten for millennia. Here then is an opportunity as opposed to commandment. And that's one of the things that differentiates Reform. How it defines commandment, how it defines mitzvah. Observing kashrut would be seen in Reform as an opportunity for a mitzvah. Shabbat observance, in particular traditional ways, would be an opportunity for performing the mitzvah. Reform will allow the individual Jew to decide how he or she is going to observe that mitzvah or whether they're going to observe it. Now, ideally, that would be based on an education in the mitzvah. That is to say, instead of a Reform Jew saying, I won't observe it because I don't feel like it, or because it's too difficult, or because it has no meaning for me. The hope would be that a Reform Jew would say, I need to understand this mitzvah better. And maybe understanding it means trying it, experiencing it, saying for the next period of time, I'm going to kosher my home. And see whether it in fact can add meaning to my life as a Jew or not. I mean, eating, pretty fundamental act. We all do it more often than we should probably, but to be aware of what you're putting in your mouth, what you're eating at every meal, is very powerful. And to say that there are boundaries in my eating, in that my eating becomes sanctified through my connection to how Jews before me and now continue to observe dietary laws can be very powerful. However, it requires a significant shift in people's lives if they haven't grown up with it. And if they observe it fully, it means that there are many places in which they won't be able to eat, and many people with whom they won't be able to eat, therefore. And that's a major shift. It's not hard to keep kosher in a place like LA. Right? Plenty of kosher food, not difficult to make your house kosher, not that difficult a regimen. It just has other consequences that on the positive level, bring you closer to your own community. Because they limit, and that's the potential negative, your interaction around meals with non-Jews or with Jews who don't observe kashrut. I think a Reformed Jew ideally would take all of that into consideration, study it, understand it more deeply, try it, and based on that, would make a decision. That would be informed choice. But the Reform movement doesn't legislate that. It would encourage the learning. Part of the way I try to do that with Shabbat, where you've got a communal setting, is the more powerful you make the Shabbat experience, the more people want to observe it. So we're coming from a different place. Right? The Torah comes from a very clear place, and Orthodoxy does. You do it. Shabbat is commanded by God. Most Jews living in the world today won't accept that as binding upon themselves. Then what do you do? Then you do it by teaching. That is, teaching in such a compelling way and getting Jews to experience the full joy and the rest of the Shabbat. The idea that there is a Shema Yetirah, that there's an additional soul that you get on Shabbat. Feeling what that means, not just having it taught didactically, but actually observing it at home and in the synagogue, more and more choose it because it helps change their lives. You know, I ski occasionally. A couple of years ago, I was in Mammoth. There's a magazine, these various freebie magazines that are put out by people who are selling ski resorts and condos and ski equipment, and the cover of it caught my attention because it had a picture of a beautiful mountain with snow, and it said the holiness of skiing. It's religious language. I opened it thinking that this would be fluff. I read the piece. It didn't mention God once, didn't mention religious. It used words like soul, spirit, spiritual, all talking about the experience of being in the mountains and skiing. I thought, this is a marketing piece. They want to sell condos. They want to sell skis. And they're doing that by selling soul, holiness, spirituality. They're not using the normal religious, they're not using God language because they figure people won't resonate to it, don't understand it, but they're using religious language. Looking at that, and my wife came home from grocery shopping, we're taking things out of the bag, and there's a bottle of some kind of a gel that the name of it was, something with soul soother. Something soul soother. It was shower gel. So they're selling soul soother. That's how they're selling shampoo. And so the marketers know something. And often much more than religious people know it. And that is that there's a spiritual hunger. When you give Jews a Shabbat experience that touches the spirit, then they'll choose to celebrate Shabbat. And with kashrut, when you teach it in such a way that helps people choose it for themselves, the potential for it touching their spirits is there. That would be more of the approach of Reform Judaism at its best.
Get personal and ask him about his own attitude towards kashrut and whether it's changed over the years.
I did not grow up observing kashrut, and for most of the years of being a rabbi, I did not observe it. I didn't eat. I didn't observe it. There's kashrut and there's not kashrut. I didn't observe kashrut, and now I do. So, in my home. So, that is to say that my wife and I made our home kosher later in life than probably lots of young rabbis coming out of the Reform Seminary today, out of the Hebrew Union College. And that's been part of my own growth as a Jew. And while someone might look at that and say, well, how could you be a rabbi and you didn't observe it, you know, 20 years ago, that's part of the not yet option for me within the Reform movement. It is to say, and it's part of, actually, the potential for any Jew to continue to grow and to develop and evolve as a Jew. So that's been part of my own experience. However, I will eat in restaurants that are not kosher restaurants. And so, you know, there are all kinds of, within among people who observe kashrut, there are varying degrees of observance. There are people who will not eat a piece of fish in a non-kosher restaurant. There are people who, on the other hand, will eat that fish and other things as well, and eat meat in a non-kosher restaurant. My degree of observance at this point in my life is that the home is kosher. This congregation, there are very few congregations that have kosher kitchens, Reform congregations, very few Reform congregations that have kosher kitchens. We're examining that in this congregation. That is, we have members of the congregation who would be pleased if we did it. We probably have many others who couldn't care less. We have some who might be opposed because they want their ice cream after their hamburger. And might say, it's a Reform congregation. Why are we doing this? Are we becoming conservative? Are we becoming Orthodox? As opposed to what I've suggested, and that is all of this is within the possibilities of Reform.
One of the subplots of this documentary on conversion to Judaism is the idea of interfaith marriage. So we wondered what the Reform movement stance is officially, and whether Rabbi Hirscher would officiate at an interfaith wedding.
The official stance of the Reform movement on rabbinic officiation at interfaith wedding ceremonies, one Jew and a Jewish partner and a non-Jewish partner. Interfaith can sometimes be misunderstood as rabbi and minister officiating together. The way I understand it, for the purposes of our conversation, the way I understand it is bride and groom are not the same faith. This is an area of greatest controversy within Jewish life in America. That is, there is a very high rate of intermarriage. We know that the numbers of children of intermarried couples who end up identifying themselves as Jews is, I think, somewhere around 28%. So the vast majority do not end up identifying themselves as part of this people, part of this religious tradition. And therefore, the concern of intermarriage is that we'll disappear. The Reform Movement, that is the Central Conference of American Rabbis, which is the organizing body of all Reform rabbis in the country, in North America, has, by means of resolution many years ago already, this is not new, taken a position against rabbinic officiation at intermarriage ceremonies, interfaith ceremonies. But the Reform movement, just as it allows Jews to make their own choices in terms of observance, allows individual rabbis to make their choices as to whether they'll officiate or not. That is probably one of the most burdensome choices that a rabbi would have to make. When I was a rabbinic student, I felt that I resolved, essentially, that I would never officiate at an interfaith wedding ceremony. Then I became a rabbi and started meeting with couples who were getting married and started hearing their stories. That is to say, I had an image in my mind of who intermarries. That image was a negative one. It was an image of a Jew who didn't really care about Judaism or about Jewish life and therefore was marrying out. It was a fairly judgmental viewpoint. Then I started meeting with Jews and their partners-to-be who didn't fit that mold, who made it more complicated for me. I found Jews who very much identified as Jews, but given the open society in which we live, that we're not living in ghettos, they met people who were not Jewish and fell in love. And so you've got the tradition and law on the one hand, and you've got love on the other. And for many Jews in America, love is going to win out over tradition. I don't even need to go into, is that good, is that bad? It is. It's the reality. Given that reality, I struggled with my initial position that I wouldn't officiate and decided that there would be circumstances under which I would officiate. Those essentially would be a non-Jewish partner who was not committed to any other religious tradition, who may have grown up in another tradition, but was not living it. It was no longer had meaning in his or her life, who was prepared to raise children as Jews, but who was prepared to do one other thing, and that is to take the same classes, the Introduction to Judaism classes, that someone seeking conversion would take. They didn't need to convert, because I never felt it's not appropriate to force a conversion either. That, according to Jewish law, invalidates the conversion. And that's what I've done through the years. That is, I spend a long time, and this doesn't happen very often. And I wouldn't have the time to do, quite honestly, the kind of work that I end up doing with those couples. But when I have a committed Jew and a non-Jew who's ready to learn, to whom I suggest that based on that learning, if he or she chooses to convert, that I'll be pleased to welcome them, but that I'm not twisting their arm to convert. That is, that I want the conversion to be a conversion of integrity and not of convenience. When I have that kind of couple, I will do their wedding. They have to take the classes. They have to meet with me regularly while they take the classes. And the Jewish partner has to attend the classes with his or her spouse-to-be. There are many people who don't want to do that. But they never feel like they've been rejected. They feel like they're meeting with someone who has some requirements. And if they can't meet them, then I'm the wrong rabbi for them. Now, in doing this, I'm trying to keep doors open to Jewish possibilities within the marriage. It's not unusual for these relationships to lead to a conversion. That's not to suggest that it's the case in the majority of the cases, but it's not unusual. And many of those couples, I've been a rabbi almost 29 years, many of those couples are in this congregation. Their children are in our schools or have been in our schools. They've been raised as Jews and identify fully as Jews. By Jewish law, they may not be Jews if it's their mother who didn't convert. Through the views of the Reform movement, they are, because of patrilineal descent. But I've found fulfillment actually in the work. My preference is to have Jews marry other Jews, or for there to be a conversion. But I know that if I don't officiate, someone else will and won't have the same kinds of requirements.
as a rabbi who sits on Beit Dins or rabbinic courts in terms of allowing converts to join the Jewish people, we asked him how he explains the fact that the Orthodox will not accept the non-Orthodox conversion.
When I help prepare someone for conversion, I indicate to that person that they're not going to be recognized by the entire Jewish world by virtue of the fact that a Reform rabbi is doing the conversion. The issue is not, within Orthodoxy, the issue is not what was the process leading toward conversion, but who was the rabbi and who were the witnesses for it. And they have to be Orthodox from an Orthodox position. That is, they have to be rabbis who are Kashrut observant, Shabbat observant, to the extent that an Orthodox rabbi would be, which usually means an Orthodox rabbi. That's true in the conservative movement. The Orthodoxy will not accept converts of anyone other than Orthodox rabbis. I let them know that, and I indicate to them the option of an Orthodox conversion. Not with me, but very, very, very rarely will anyone do that, because in order to do it, to some degree, they'll have to be dishonest. If they're not going to observe Shabbat entirely according to Jewish law, or observe Kashrut, or other mitzvot, then they can't convert with an Orthodox rabbi, because an Orthodox rabbi will ask them those questions, and they'd have to be less than truthful with that rabbi. I've said to people, you know, that you don't want to begin a conversion with that kind of lack of integrity. If you're going to do it with an Orthodox rabbi, then you should become Orthodox. And that's why few will do it. No one wants to think of his conversion as lacking integrity, and it shouldn't. So they know going in what the issues are. Those issues today, assuming they continue to live their lives in America particularly, will most likely never affect them. That's not the case in Israel. If a child of a woman convert to Judaism who might decide at age 20 to go live in Israel will be accepted as a Jew in Israel according to the law of return, but will not be married there by Orthodox rabbis. And they're the only ones allowed legally to do those marriages. That's a highly unlikely scenario for most of the people I meet with.
We now discuss the Reform movement's view of Israel.
It is true that the Reform movement early on in America was not a Zionistic movement, to say the least. That is, there were Reform rabbis and Reform Jews who were not, who really against the establishment of a state, or certainly not supportive of the, more not supportive of the establishment of the state. The reasons for that are a little complex, but mostly I think they have to do with a sense early in the Reform movement of universalism. When the first Pittsburgh platform was written, enunciating the values of Reform Judaism in the late 1800s, that platform spoke of kind of a universal world order that was just around the corner. That is, they really believed, many were believing, that we were going to have a world at peace and brotherhood, and that was coming near. They were kind of, within the Reform movement, there was a messianism. Not about a Messiah coming, but about a messianic era, that the world was really changing. This is pre-World War I, that changed all of that. And therefore significantly pre the Holocaust. historical events changed Jewish life and consciousness. And you had leaders in the Reform movement who were absolutely in opposition to the anti-Zionistic approach. One of them was Stephen S. Wise, for whom this congregation is named, and that gives you a sense of what the place stands for. And he was an ardent Zionist long before the Reform movement was. And there were others, Abba Hillel Silver, great leaders in American Reform Judaism who were passionate Zionists, who helped create the state. The Hebrew University, the Judah Magnus, who helped create the great Hebrew University of Israel. These were Reform leaders. But it wasn't where Reform Judaism was at its core at the time. Once Israel was created, a state was established, and in really post-Holocaust, there were still Reform Jews who were not particularly excited about a state of Israel. I think they were more and more in the minority. Many Reformers felt that America was their Zion. That is, this, imagine, you know, immigrants coming to America, finding religious freedom, finding economic freedom, public school systems. Jews of Eastern Europe certainly knew nothing of those. That is, opportunities for education, for becoming part of the country, a great love, understandably and rightly, for this country. What did we need another country for? What did we need to reestablish Jewish sovereignty in any place? The world was opening up to us. That was the thinking in those years, and that's why Zionism was not part of the Reform movement. I've always been an ardent Zionist. I love Israel. I think I have a congregation that loves Israel, and the Reform movement today is deeply Zionistic. There's even ARTSA, the Association of Reform Zionists of America. There was a time where Reform and Zionist wouldn't have been spoken in the same breath. That, for me, that's ancient history. It's important, but it is not at all reflective of Reform today. The importance of Israel. For me, Zionism is, well, the modern manifestation of Zionism with Theodor Herzl in the late 19th century is recent. Zionism for me is as old as Abraham. Abraham is told to leave his native land and go to a land that God will show him, and to be a blessing in that land. So there's a promise made to Abraham, and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph all know that promise, that it's made to them. And the Jewish people in Egypt continue to dream of it in their slavery. And when they're wandering in the desert for 40 years, they're wandering toward someplace, toward a mountain to receive Torah, toward Mount Sinai, and then on with that Torah as a guide to the land of Israel, and they do battle for it, and great struggle, and they create sovereignty within it, and they rule themselves for the first time. And we lose that a couple of times and find ourselves in exile for 2,000 years. And then in exile, here's one of the incredible dimensions of Jewish life. Very hard for people who don't feel it, experience it in their bodies and in their souls, to understand it. But for a people to be in exile without a land for 2,000 years, and every day to pray for a return to it, to hold on to that as a dream, I don't know that that's ever happened in the history of humankind. That any dream, I mean, in a sense, it's so totally irrational, it's crazy, that people would hold on to dreams that long. And to hope. And yet the Jewish people did, and the hope is realized. That Theodor Herzl said in 1898 that in 50 years there would be a state. And he called his book was The Jewish State, and another one, Alt Neuland, Old New Land, was his vision. Again, the renewal of the old. And that 50 years later, in fact, it was established. And his sense that if this is what you willed, it wouldn't be a dream, that it would be a reality, that you needed enough spirit, enough will to make it happen. That, in a nutshell, is an incredible story. Begin to unfold that story, and it's nothing short of wondrous. And then that the national anthem of Israel becomes Hatikva, the hope. There is no other national anthem that where its core value is hope. After 2,000 years to be a free people in our own land. So now we've had that as a state for about almost 56 years. Not to see it in the context of Abraham to the present is to miss the grandeur of the vision. If it's 56 years old, well, there are a lot of other states that are relatively new, but there aren't any others that have where there's been that dream for that length of time. A number of years ago, the Dalai Lama, being in exile from Tibet, gathered a group of rabbis and asked them what was the secret. How did Jews maintain their hope of return? For all of those years, he wanted to know it because of the plight of his own people. So that when we talk about Israel today, a real state with, where now all of the values of Judaism get tested. Because it's not just the land of pioneers drying up swamps, making the desert bloom. All of that's true. And the story is incredibly great, awe-inspiring, but it's also an Israel at war. And an Israel with power, an Israel that I believe struggles more than any other nation. I don't think I'm prone to exaggeration. I think Israel struggles more than any other powerful nation with the just and right use of its power. And I think it does that despite the fact that most Israelis are secular. They're rooted in a biblical text. They may not go to the synagogue regularly, but they're rooted in Jewish values, and they want the state to be not only secure, they want it to be a place of justice. And that's very hard to do. The United States is a nation with, as we know, the most powerful nation in the world. We know we don't always succeed in the use of that power. Israel doesn't always succeed in the way it wants to use it. And there are times where innocents are hurt or killed. There are injustices along the way. And yet the Israeli army has a document called Ruach Tzahal, which means the spirit of the military, which talks about all kinds of possible conflicts that you'd come into and how you use power under those circumstances and what you're not allowed to do. And saying, as certain Nazi perpetrators of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, said, when they were put on trial, I was only following orders. Israeli soldiers know that that's not, that they can't say ever, I was only following orders. So it's a nation that I take great pride in because I believe that it struggles to know how to use its power, to use it morally, to take care of its people, to live by certain values, knowing that the Messiah hasn't come, it won't all be perfect today, but that you build toward a future. So that when we come to the question of peace, there are days where I'd say I'm not optimistic, but I haven't lost hope. As Hatikva comes back, the prophet Isaiah described the Jewish people as being asirei tikva, prisoners of hope, which is an incredible statement. It is, you can't escape it, that you hope holds on to you, that you're never allowed to despair. So that when I look at the situation in Israel, even in those moments where I feel great despair, and how can you not? I'm not done hoping, and I think Israelis are, I know Israelis are not done hoping, that what they want most is to get to a peace agreement and to live peacefully with her neighbors. If you were to ask me, do I think that's around the corner, I'd say, no, I don't, sadly. I think that will take a change of heart on the part of the Arab world for it to be realized. Israel's ready for it. Israel, it's all that Israel wants.
We wondered if Rabbi Hersher could point to some of his favorite teachings in Judaism.
There are certain statements that I think have incredible power. One of those is that, I have to think of the Hebrew. Hayom katsar, the day is short, v'hamlacha meruba, and the work is great, v'hapoalim atzelim, and the workers are lazy, they're sluggish, v'asachar harbe, but the reward is great, uval habayit dochek, and the master of the house is waiting, is impatient. That is, that there is such great work to be done in the world and in our lives, and we don't always take it as seriously as we should. The reward for it is incredibly great in terms of our fulfillment and for the world itself, and that's what God wants of us. God is waiting. Another one says, this is for the days in which you feel that there's so much work to do that you just can't do it all. Good work in the world. The text says, Lo alecha hamlacha ligmor. It's not incumbent upon you to complete the work. Ve lo ata ben chorin lehivatel mimena. You're also not free to desist from it. You're not free not to do the work because it's so great. You don't have to finish the job, but you need to do your part. I think that's important because in the culture we live in, we're very achievement-oriented and success-oriented, and we have certain ways of measuring it. When it comes to repairing the world, it's an effort that we won't complete. But we're so goal-oriented that it's not just in this culture. It must have been in the culture of the Talmud as well, for the rabbis to have said this, that don't worry about finishing it. Just keep doing it. In terms of stories in the Talmud, there is one, it's hard to choose a story, but one of those that I love the most is the rabbis are arguing about a particular legal point. I won't go into the legal point, but they disagree with each other vociferously. One of them has a point of view that all the rest disagree with. And since he can't win his argument, he says, if I am right, let that tree over there uproot itself and replant itself over there. And the rabbis were not literalists. The tree does that. The other rabbis object, says, you can't prove an argument by a tree doing that. You got to use your logic, your rationality. The rabbi tries again, if I'm right, let that river reverse course, a few such examples. They don't accept him, his way of doing things. Finally, he says, if I am right, let a bat kol, a voice from the heavens, a voice from God, come forth and say, Rabbi Yehuda is right. The voice comes forth. It says the law is according to what the rabbi says. The other voices, the other rabbis, tell God to be quiet. They say, Lo bashamayim hi, which is a quote from the Torah. They're quoting God's text back to God, which says, it is not in the heavens. It is, the Torah is not there anymore. God, you gave it to us. We're the ones who have to live the text, and we're the ones who have to interpret it. Don't interfere with us. No voices from the heavens. God's response to that is to smile and say, my children have defeated me, my children have defeated me. He says it with pleasure. An incredible parenting image, by the way. That is, I've raised you, and I've taught you what I know, or what I believe you need to know. I've given you my Torah. And then there's a point at which I've got to let you go. Just as a parent and a child, that is, you may not interpret the text in quite the same way I do. And you guys will have to fight it out down there and figure out how this Torah becomes a Torah of life, truly, for you. It's a statement by the rabbis of the importance of human interpretation. It's saying that there is a degree of openness to interpretation that not even God can interfere with. That God gave us the gift of Torah, now it's ours. We're going to figure out how to live by it. It's a beautiful teaching, in the Talmud, which can be interpreted a million different ways, but that's how I like to interpret it.
Why is Judaism called Judaism? To Rabbi Hirsch's credit, he gives his opinion, but ultimately he's able to say he doesn't know.
The way that the territory was divided up of the land of Israel when the Israelites entered was by tribes. Each tribe had its possession. The area around Jerusalem and its environs was Yehuda, was Judah. The other tribes disappeared, and the tribe of Israel in the north was defeated. That essentially left Yehuda, Judah. And so that my assumption would be that the reason it's Yahadut, Judaism, is because that was the house of David. That was the kingship of Israel. That's why the name became Judaism. But I have to tell you, if you want to be sure you got accuracy, I'd have to look back. I don't even know.
We now ask him to react to a hypothetical scenario. What would he do if one of his children decided to convert out of Judaism?
Wow. If one of my children announced that he or she had found Jesus and wanted to convert to Christianity, there'd be a number of reactions. I'd be astounded that it might happen. But such things happen. I'd be astounded, given the way I've raised them and the way they identify, I'd be astounded. But it's not outside the realm of possibility for a child in a Jewish family to say that. There are conversions to Christianity as there are conversions to Judaism. Aside from wanting to be a good father, which would mean wanting to enter a dialogue and understand what was going on, which I hope would be the initial way I'd respond. If it turned out that I wasn't able to help turn that around, because it's not, that this is not, I hope this would not be offensive to Christianity to know that any Jew who takes his or her Judaism seriously, identifies deeply, sees himself as part of a history, of 4,000 years, any Jew who feels that he stood at Sinai and received the commandments, that he was present with Abraham when God said, look up into the heavens and try to count the stars, I'll make your people that numerous, be a blessing to that world. Every Jew who is deeply connected in these kinds of ways, and I could list many others that are part of the story for me, would want his and her children to be part of that same story, to know the narrative and embody it and live it. So it would be considered a great loss. And I can't, there are not too many things. There are other things that are more painful, but there aren't too many that would be as personally painful to me as to have my child leave Judaism. Not just for Christian, for any other religious tradition, to actually convert out, to make a statement that I am leaving home for another home, and then we're not going to share a home anymore. Not as a family and not as a people. I doubt, it's not in my nature to react to something like that with anger. But there would be deep sorrow. Because in my children there's also hopes for a Jewish future.
Now the topic turns to anti-Semitism, and remember, this conversation takes place in the year 2004 or 2005.
I don't believe that there's a rise of anti-Semitism in America, and I don't think the studies show that there is. So every year anti-Semitic incidents are counted, and they're clearly defined, and I think those numbers have been getting better over the years, and I think that Jews are incredibly blessed by living in America. I think Americans are incredibly blessed by living in America. With whatever shortcomings we've got, America strives, I believe, to be better. And while we've still got painful racial prejudice, things seem to me to be better today than they were 25 years ago, and better 25 years ago than they were 50 years ago. And one of the important things about anti-Semitism when it comes to America, to differentiate it from Europe, is that America has never had government policy that was anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism in Europe, historically, up to the Holocaust, in many European countries, was government policy. Until the emancipation, it was government policy, and then only slowly evolved. That kind of history is not part of the history of the United States government. So if there are anti-Semites, which there are, clearly, and there are crazy people, there are nuts, there are extremes, they've never been allowed to get power sufficient to really act on their anti-Semitism in any ways approximating what we experienced a generation ago in Europe. European anti-Semitism does seem to be on the rise and is of grave concern. A certain amount of European anti-Semitism comes out of, not Europe, as much as it's coming out of radical, extreme Islam, of large numbers of Muslims living in France who foment a certain amount of that anti-Semitism. And much of what's happened in France against Jews or Jewish institutions has come from a radical element. It's very, very, and it's complex. And certainly, Europe has been fertile soil historically for anti-Semitism. I'm not one, though, as a Jew in America, I'm not one to be, I think we need to be vigilant, and that's why it's good that there are Jewish defense organizations. It's good to be vigilant, but not to the extreme that we become paranoid. we're living in incredibly friendly territory, as far as I'm concerned. And there have never been anywhere in the world, anywhere in Jewish history, there's never been the opportunities for Jews as there are in this country. My personal experience of anti-Semitism is limited. I once lived in an apartment where someone scratched a swastika on my door. That pained me deeply. It didn't create fear, however. Could have been a neighborhood kid, for all I know, so that I don't want it to attribute to something like that. I grew up in a congregation in San Jose where I arrived for religious school one Sunday morning, and they kept us out for a while because someone had broken in the night before and painted swastikas on the walls. And they wanted to cover it, to paint it over before we came in. I don't know if they needed to do that, actually, but that's another issue. However, as a Jew, and as Eli Hirscher, to ask, have I experienced it personally, I don't separate me from my people, and I certainly can't separate me from my family. That is, my parents left Germany in 1935, but four of their siblings didn't, and their parents didn't. So I grew up with very few aunts and uncles and very few cousins and no grandparents. There was always an awareness in my home of where I came from, why I was where I was. That is, why was I born in Israel? I was born in Israel because of anti-Semitism. Why were my parents there? Why was their immigration not one really of choice, but of necessity? So that I've been blessed, the reality is no, I have, the anti-Semitism I've experienced is nothing. Serious anti-Semitism I experienced through my family and through the Jewish people, and that's very real to me. But I don't live in that. I think that's very important. Let me say a word about the Holocaust and that. The being a child essentially of survivors, and being a conscious Jew, the Holocaust is deeply a part of who I am. But it's not where I live, and it's not where I want Jews to live. I want Jews to learn. I want them to be deeply aware. I want them to feel the pain of it. But if they stay there, that's certainly not what I want to teach my children. I want to teach my children that they need to know it, and in spite of it, and even because of it, to create a Jewish life that is going to be hopeful and vibrant and full of joy and deep. And so that when I now look at the Holocaust, in addition to the pain at the horror of it, and worlds that were lost, Jewish worlds, Jewish lives, Jewish culture, language, literature, creativity, future that was lost, I also look at, because I need to find some redemption somewhere, and I find that in the righteous Gentiles. That is, while most did not help, many did. And more of their stories have come to light. And when I look at non-Jews who hid Jews, not for any monetary reward, but who hid them because they believed that was the right thing to do, and many of them were religious Christians. The penalty for them would have been that they would have been killed had they been found out. That to me is the Holocaust is an example of the degradation to which human beings can descend, and the righteous Gentiles are an indication of the heights to which human beings can choose to go. That, when I read those stories now, I'm deeply moved, I'm inspired, And I'm led to a question of, if God forbid anything like it happened to any other people, where would I be? Who would I be? What would I do? There the righteous Gentiles would have a lot to teach me about what it means to be a human being. And that was neglected for a long time. The stories were neglected. It was only our pain. And only our pain isn't enough. It's that there were those who saved us. And we need to rejoice in them. Some of them are still alive. There are Jews who I do what I can to make contributions to sustaining them in dignity in their old age, which is a great cause. So that when it comes to anti-Semitism, I don't want anti-Semitism or the Holocaust to define me as a Jew. I don't want my enemy to define me as a Jew. I don't want to live with fear. And I don't. When I go to Israel, and I go twice a year, I go just with a great, great excitement, great joy, and fulfillment, and I try to convey that to Jews, that there's an attack in Israel, and Israelis have to get up the next morning, and they got to go to work, and they got to go to school, and they got to live their lives. And for us not to go, because of mostly irrational fears, is untenable for me. So there's the joy of Jewish living and the power of it, not just a history of anti-Semitism. That can't define our story.
Wow, that was great. Thank you, Rabbi Hersher. A phenomenal interview, and we wish you only the best. May you live long and be well. Now, what else can you do? You can subscribe to this show, you can write a review, and you can shop at our sponsor, Hazaka.com. That's HAZAKAH.com. Jewish games that feed the brain. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
All right, that's it. Hot as hell, Jay.